You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Just over a month ago, while you and I were dealing with the pandemic, with buying new masks, washing our hands for the sixth time in one day, and wondering if a vaccine had been developed yet, something happened high up in the Himalayas. There were two groups of soldiers under two different flags. There was brutal violence. There were many deaths. Was there going to be a war?
Nuclear powers facing off in a remote corner of the Himalayas.
India says at least 20 of its soldiers were killed in a clash with Chinese forces.
Indian and Chinese soldiers fought on disputed land using stones and bamboo poles.
There is little evidence of what led to Indian and Chinese soldiers engaging in a deadly brawl at their border on Monday.
Instead, something very different happened. There were no shots fired. There were no guns. Not only did the two armies step back, there were no photographs, no video, no first-hand reporting from the scene. There were no war correspondents. Two nuclear-armed neighbors had their soldiers fighting hand-to-hand, to the death, but then stepped back from a full-scale confrontation. Welcome to the latest edition of Inside China. My name is Jared Watt. I'm the Specialist Digital Editor at the South China Morning Post. In this episode, we're going to look at how China and India found themselves on the brink of war, high up in the Himalayas, and stepped back, but didn't step down. We're going to look at what has happened since then, and why the leaders of these two nations with reputations for vigorous nationalism both chose to quietly settle things down. And we're going to look at the complicated relationship that links Russia, China, India, and the United States, and how each nation is carefully playing its cards in this very high-stakes game of influence, economic power, and military supremacy. So let's get an idea of where this violent and bloody confrontation occurred. It happened in a part of the Himalayas that's described as a snow desert, a series of mountain ranges, sheer cliffs and rocky valleys, an inhospitable moonscape. They might see one or two lonely goat herders pass through, but not much else. And through it all runs a 3,488-kilometre long line on a map that separates three northern states of India from the Chinese Tibet Autonomous Region. It's called the Line of Actual Control, the LAC, a phrase that is left over from 1962, when China and India really did go to war over control of this territory. And since then, it's become the border between China and India that has for years been a source of tension. Now let me introduce you to Kunal Purwit, who's been covering this story from India. He's an independent journalist based in Mumbai. For the last few months, he's been contributing articles to the South China Morning Post on these border tensions. Now on the 10th of June, Kunal published what we call an explainer piece about the border dispute at the line of actual control. Now this is a quote from his piece.
There have been six decades of claims and counterclaims along the 3,488-kilometer unmarked boundary between China and India, known as the line of actual control, and both sides will be watching each other with suspicion.
Just 7 days after the SCMP published this piece, 20 Indian soldiers were dead. And two nuclear-armed neighbours were sending troops and armed vehicles to reinforce their side of the border. The full list of fatalities remains unknown. China has acknowledged it suffered casualties on its side, but has not released any details.
India and China have been locked in this sort of eyeball-to-eyeball almost dispute of sorts along various parts of the LAC, the line of actual control, as you mentioned it. And, you know, in such situations, a lot of the army veterans that I've spoken to say that the tempers do run high on both sides. You know, here are soldiers and troops who've been amassed alongside each other. They've been sort of facing each other. There are a lot of provocations that happen from both sides. So on that particular day, 7 days later, as you say, on the 15th of June, what we do know so far, piecing together accounts from both sides, is that there was an altercation between Indian troops and Chinese troops. The altercation got extremely violent, which it hadn't been till that point. You know, the kind of level of violence that we saw that day was unprecedented, you know, in the history between India and China. And just the gruesomeness of it, you know, it's not as much the violence, but the gruesomeness of it. I mean, there have been reports that both sides, used things like clubs and rods, which were spiked with nails, as well as stones to counter each other and hit back at each other. And a lot of the soldiers actually, Jared, died because they, you know, in the middle of the battle, they fell into a river which passes by. So a lot of the soldiers actually died from hypothermia. And again, I mean, you know, these are the kind of grisly details that make you shudder about the kind of tempers and the kind of provocations that must be running high in these 11 weeks that the two sides have been, eyeball to eyeball.
So to put it bluntly, why didn't China and India go to war over this?
Just after the incident happened, someone wrote a piece in an international publication saying that India and China owe it to the world to settle their dispute, you know, because they're two of the largest countries in the world, two of the most powerful militaries, and despite which they can't get their act together. And I would say, you know, I think it's just that point of reflection that we need to sort of, you know, look at and admire the fact that both countries, despite the provocations, did not launch into a situation where they used weapons against each other. There's been a lot of dispute in India. There's been a lot of political debate as well about why the Indian soldiers did not fall back on arms and did not use the weapons that they already had at that point. You know, I mean, we were in the conflict for about 5 or 6 weeks at that point when it happened. The simple reason is this. There are border agreements between India and China which prohibit the use of fire weapons and the use of artillery in situations like these, you know. So there are clear laid down rules that as a matter of de-escalation, neither of the two sides will use fire weapons and neither of the two sides will use guns. And that was actually one of the key reasons why we've also managed to, you know, in some ways curb the number of casualties that both sides have suffered. I mean, you imagine a situation like this with machine guns and with all kinds of artillery piled up on both sides of the border, and you have a situation which is extremely dangerous and very difficult to then control and predict. So the simple reason is, logistically speaking, this is what the two countries decided, that they wanted this to be a very limited, you know, military skirmish of sorts. Geopolitically, Jared, you know, the answer is that both countries at this point realize that a war is not suited for their interests, you know. On the Chinese side, we're already seeing this kind of economic backlash that China is suffering from various different countries. You know, we're also seeing that geopolitically, it's making its moves in various parts of the world, including Hong Kong. I don't believe China would have wanted to open up another front, and a front as dangerous and as unpredictable as the Indian front. On the Indian side as well, similar reasons, especially on the economic front. You know, India is in the middle of an unprecedented sort of slowdown. We've had unprecedented job losses, you know, at least unprecedented in the last 4 decades. You know, war is not really what the country also needs at this point. We're also suffering immense number of layoffs, both in the organized and the unorganized sector, you know, which is the latter is actually the backbone of the Indian economy. And things look very, very grim for India. And at this point, India wouldn't want to have, a full-blown military conflict that it faces, which is why I think both countries, despite their reputation really of having leaders who stoke up a lot of nationalism, who stoke up nationalist sentiments whenever it is convenient to them, despite that fact, both countries have very mutually sort of decided to keep the lid on the sentiments that this might inflame.
If you're listening right now and wondering, why didn't I hear about this? Why didn't I see videos about this? There's a very good reason. No journalists can get there. There were no TV crews that were able to travel to this location. And unlike the wars in the Middle East, which since the 1990s have been almost made for TV events, on this occasion, there was almost nothing. All we got was shaky, handheld, and unverified videos shot on phones from the Indian side of soldiers pushing and shoving each other, and from the Chinese side, dramatic videos of troop movements in trucks towards the border. Meanwhile, some news organizations access satellite photos showing the build-up of both armies on either side. And here in Hong Kong, our reporters were trying to get information on what was happening, and Kunal was in Mumbai trying to do the same. In some respects, it was like trying to cover world news in the 19th century with vaguely worded telegrams and not much else to go on.
I think it's been extremely challenging to bring out reports which are objective, which are balanced, and also which are extremely accurate and you know, factually backed. The reason is this, you know, we obviously have China, which is not going to, you know, show the kind of transparency that one would expect from a government. It does not issue reports. It has still not clarified the number of deaths that might have occurred or the number of injuries that might have had on the Chinese side. But we also have the Indian government on this, in this particular case, which has been notoriously opaque about what has been happening on the LAC. The reason why I say this is that on almost a day-to-day basis, there's been little or no update that comes from the Indian side as well on what is happening, you know, on the border really. And whatever updates do come are often, you know, sort of source-based updates is what we call it in journalism, right? Where there is no one who's willing to put their neck out and sort of, you know, allow us to quote that person saying that this is exactly what is happening. The danger of such, you know, I mean, reporting on such a conflict is that you can often be carried and swayed by interests on either sides, you know, because no one's really willing to be officially attributing any comments to them, neither the Indian government nor the Chinese side. Also, on the other side, the militaries of both sides have not been very, very open about what has happened. So what you now have is that a handful of journalists who are closer to the government or who are closer to the military than the others are accessed to very filtered information. It's close to impossible to actually ascertain and verify whether this information that they are finally getting is accurate or whether it's just a very convenient explanation of the events that have happened. So the problem is also this. I mean, because we don't have a very good sense of what has happened, the reporting on both sides tends to be very colored with, you know, nationalistic sentiments ingrained in the accounts that it, you know, it gets. So we will always get, in India, we will always get accounts which show India to be on the better side of things, and the same with China. And I think that is an extremely dangerous position for journalism to exist in, because we're honestly not sure of the accuracy of a lot of the inputs that we get. So as a journalist, my job is then to verify with a lot of others and write with a lot of caution about the kind of things that we're reporting on. So we tend to report on things where we find attribution, or we then try and, you know, sort of verify it from a number of sources if you're not being able to find attribution.
And while we might not ever know what really happened that night, thousands of meters above sea level on a mountain pass in the Himalayas, we definitely know what's happened since at the government and economic levels. Two leaders, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi and China's President Xi Jinping, both have employed strong nationalistic themes to inspire their people in the recent past. So where was the fiery rhetoric from these men after this incident? Where were the powerful words of national pride backed by media cheerleading for decisive military responses?
I'll start off with the Indian side first. Now, if you look at Prime Minister Modi and his 6 years of being in power, he has used nationalism extremely conveniently at various points of his political career, especially in this chair. For example, just before the elections last year, when he was up for what seemed at that point to be a tight re-election, you know, he displayed the nationalism card where, you know, there was a terrorist attack that happened. You know, in fact, there was a militant attack where 40 CRPF, which is paramilitary soldiers from the Indian side, died in that suicide bomb attack. And, you know, the Prime Minister sort of launched into this attack of asking for retaliation, you know, saying that he had proof that Pakistan was behind this attack. And we, you know, as we now know, as the world now knows, we launched into, you know, some sort of, they call it surgical strikes. I mean, we had air strikes where, you know, Indian aircraft did sort of bomb certain places in Pakistan to avenge the fact that, you know, soldiers had died. Even before that, you know, we've seen that another similar terrorist attack in India had led to Indian soldiers crossing the line of control with Pakistan, entering into Pakistani-controlled territory and killing and eliminating terrorists and you know, other officials there. Now, you know, contrast that with the approach that Prime Minister Modi and the Indian government have taken against China. In the second instance that I told you, you know, where troops actually crossed the border and went in, India had lost about 17 soldiers to the terrorist attack. So logistically speaking, we've actually lost more soldiers in this current conflict with China. And despite which, we've seen the prime minister, who normally adopts a very, very strong line, to actually be, you know, not firstly being very visible and not very vocal on this issue. So he's actually spoken only a few times, a handful of times, in fact. In one of the criticisms domestically against him is that he's not naming China. You know, in all of his, you know, he's referring to the incidents without actually naming China. And that a lot of political commentators have found to be very interesting and found to be quite symptomatic of the fact that he's very conscious that he's dealing with, you know, with a far stronger power, that he's not very, very keen on taking on militarily at this point. So that's the Indian aspect. On the Chinese side, if you look at it, you know, President Xi hasn't really made statements about this particular conflict in all of this while. We've also seen a lot of the Chinese media, which generally, I mean, in the previous times, whenever India and China have had some sort of a, you know, military standoff, outlets like the Global Times, for instance, use the opportunity very, very well to whip up nationalistic sentiments. And we did not see that happening till at least this particular incident on June 15th. It's only then, for a few days in that too, only for a few days that we saw, you know, the Chinese media sort of, you know, whipping up all of these sentiments. So I think these departures from what has traditionally been the approach from both sides, I think reflects a mutually agreed upon strategy that they, you know, while they might want to keep this on the low burner and not completely put it out, they also don't want this to be a fire that engulfs them completely. You know, so that's also one crucial way in which both sides have actually kept nationalist sentiments on the check.
But while diplomatically things have calmed down, economically it's a different story. India didn't start a trade war, the kind of thing Donald Trump launched a couple of years ago with massive tariffs on goods coming from China, and there's a very good reason why. So let's ask Kunal, why didn't India launch a trade war with China?
The answer to that, in some ways, lies in understanding the dynamics that India and China right now share and how those dynamics actually limit the options that India then has on the table to respond to a more aggressive China. On the trade front, for instance, India imports the maximum number of goods from China. So China is number one on that list of importers. That alone, for instance, and if you look at the range of things that India imports from China, it's, you know, things as important as semiconductors for electrical and technological appliances, to something as banal as electrical decoration lights, to even furniture. So there is a range of products in which there is immense dependence on Chinese manufacturing. Now, you know, not all of this is extremely dispensable in nature. You know, we as I did a story a couple of weeks ago as well, close to 60% of the imports that India gets from China are actually goods which are not finished goods. So they are goods that are then used to then manufacture finished goods in India. Now, what then happens if India does cut off this dependence is that India's own manufacturing will take, you know, quite a big hit, which is why the question about what India does economically with China is then so important, you know, because India has to, again, weigh its options very carefully and yet present some sort of a strong sign that it's not going to take things for granted and it's not going to be business as usual with China.
But India did reply to China in a very specific, very 21st century way.
One of the things that India has done becomes so interesting, which, as you know, has been, you know, the decision by the Indian government to ban, close to 60 applications, mobile applications, which are mostly all of them from China, you know, and built by Chinese companies. A lot of them include very, very popular apps like TikTok, like CamScanner. You know, these are all utility apps. These are all entertainment apps that are extremely popular. And that, I think, is one of the clearest and one of the most solid signs that the Indian establishment is now looking at controlling, you know, the entry that Chinese capital has got into India's markets. It could be India's digital markets, as the decision says. It could also be in India's infrastructure markets. So a lot of the Chinese infrastructure companies which actually come to India to build and to business have now been restricted, or there have been specific instructions given by government departments to restrict Chinese capital from investing or from participating in big infrastructure projects. You know, that's one of the other things that has happened. The other thing that the Indian government is also doing is understanding where, you know, and what positions is it in to actually control the entry of Chinese companies and Chinese capital. So, for instance, the power ministry, you know, which handles the country's power infrastructure, that has now made, you know, made certain decisions with regard to the use of Chinese equipment in India's power systems, right? Even the kind of solar equipment that India does import, that is likely to see some sort of restrictions. So, you know, you're seeing a very careful strategy where, you know, they're identifying and targeting Chinese capital and Chinese presence, at least in the departments where India still has alternatives, and then trying to sort of, you know, trying to block it out, or trying to create some sort of roadblocks for, you know, the entry of such capital. And my gut feeling is this is only going to increase with time.
We've got some big news coming to you about the South China Morning Post. Starting in August, we're bringing in a brand new digital subscription service. You'll still get unlimited access to our new and archived podcasts, but we're going to ask you to sign up for a subscription to access SCMP.com and the SCMP mobile app. It's going to work like this. You'll be able to read several stories each month for free, and after that, you'll need to be a subscriber to access more. You'll be helping to support SCMP's award-winning news reporting, in-depth analysis, and investigative journalism that lead the global conversation on China. We're introducing this in stages to our different audiences around the world, but you'll read all about it first at our website, scmp.com.
Now, in February of this year, US President Donald Trump made a very high-profile visit to India. And since then, we've seen some very public announcements of weapon sales from the US to India, as well as the beginning this week of a joint exercise involving US and Indian naval ships, which some are saying is an increasing sign that India and the US are teaming up to keep a check on China.
India and the US have been on this path of, you know, aligning themselves closely with each other on various things, including defense cooperation, as you said. The relationship actually, you know, in some ways has been one of convenience, you know, because the US has wanted, you know, a counterbalance force to the rise of China in the subcontinent, especially, and in South Asia. Whereas for India, the US, you know, is obviously one of the biggest diasporas that the Indian community has, one of the biggest culture centers as well in some ways. And also, obviously, you know, it always helps to have a superpower like the US, you know, behind you, getting your back, right? And supporting you on various things, right from greater say in the United Nations to, you know, a bigger role in the Security Council as well. So there are obviously benefits to it. Now, the reason why India and the US have also gotten closer is obviously a realization within Indian establishment, you know, circles as well, that a lot of the interests that the US and India have, especially around the region, are actually quite in alignment with each other, you know. And one of the key interests that the both have is basically to keep a check on a rising and on an aggressive China. And that's been a point of mutual convergence for the two countries. So the US at this point, you know, because it's in this protracted sort of cold trade war with China, sees great merit in backing India on these things, you know, on the fact that there have been sort of military skirmishes, there has been a border standoff as well. So the US does see a lot of merit in it, and India also seeks comfort in the fact that they have the backing of the US.
But for India, there's something of a geopolitical paradox, a quandary, if you will, because while the United States and India share some strategic interests, India has a bit of a problem, and it starts with the commander-in-chief of the US Armed Forces.
What does matter to India immensely is the lack of continuity that, you know, it gets from a country like the US under a president like Donald Trump. Donald Trump, for instance, can be extremely unpredictable and can be quite nightmarish to track if you are sitting in New Delhi and in the foreign ministry office. Because on one day he will back you on something, but the other day, other morning, he'll tweet against you, you know, about a trade barrier that you might have put up. So that presents a very, very awkward situation for a lot of countries, including India. One of the things that President Trump has done in this particular conflict has that is, you know, he's tweeted about the fact that he's happy to mediate between the two countries. Now, I was talking to, you know, diplomats in New Delhi, and they actually told me that they were quite disappointed with his statement, you know, because at that point, while India and China are locked in this border standoff, what they needed President Trump is actually to, you know, to bring more support on the table and not make an offer of mediation, which basically means you're placing both countries at an equal level, you know, saying, you know, you both might have some points, let me hear you out. Whereas India at that point was looking for unequivocal support from the US, which it didn't get.
And while news media around the world love to quote Donald Trump's tweets, and it's very handy to run the photos and video supplied by the US Navy about its exercises in the Indian Ocean, Kunal has a few insights on the role of Russia in mediating the dispute between India and China.
Russia, you know, the country that you mentioned, has had a very, very interesting role to play in this whole scenario. Russia is extremely close to India and has been traditionally so. But Russia is also extremely close to China. In fact, a lot of commentators, a lot of foreign policy analysts argue that Russia is actually closer to China today than it is to India. You know, in fact, someone I quoted in my piece, a foreign policy analyst, said that given a choice, Russia would choose China over India any day. But you know, leave that aside for a minute and keep in mind the fact that, you know, Russia is also India's biggest defense supplier, right? Close to 60% of India's arms and weapons have come from Russia. Russia is also close to China, especially on defense matters. You know, they've had defense cooperation and defense knowledge sharing agreements between them. At this point, what Russia does is that, you know, it tries to talk to both countries, but on the back channels. You know, it doesn't come out and make a grand statement like President Trump, but it does something much more effective. Where, during the Victory Day parade that it had, it invited both the Indian and the Chinese defense ministers and had separate meetings with both countries. Now, mind you, this is right after the two countries had a violent skirmish, you know, which has not been precedented in their history. So the fact that both countries and defense ministers agree to fly down to Russia and to Moscow to meet officials in Russia, following that, Russia then holds a very interesting trilateral meeting between Russia, India, and China. So the RIC summit, as we call it. Now, there was great speculation at this point whether India would even, you know, want to participate, or India would want to show its protest by not attending the meet and not being on the same diplomatic platform as China. But India decided to attend it. And I think the fact that it participated in that summit along with China shows that, you know, it was Russia which was actually a very key player, because it managed to convince both countries to leave their differences aside, come together for this summit and talk of issues which are important for all three. And I feel like Russia in some ways also holds the key to the equation at this point, you know, because Russia, as you know, Russia continues to be an important partner for China, but it also continues to be an important defense partner for India. So we need to wait and watch on how Moscow plays its cards in the next coming few months or coming few years.
So there's one last question to ask Kunal about the current situation. How does he describe the current status between China and India right now? Is it détente, uneasy calm, or is it a tense standoff?
I mean, you know, we're now in the 11th week of the standoff. You know, if we even consider early May to be the beginning of this entire episode, we're still 11 weeks into the standoff. Bear in mind the fact that we've already seen extremely high levels of gruesome violence between the two troops. In such a scenario, the suspicions between the troops on the ground run extremely high. I was talking to some of the army veterans and some of the serving military officers in India, and they were saying that, you know, when something like this happens, it becomes extremely difficult to then control the troops in a situation like this, you know, because they're obviously so overcome with emotion as well, seeing some of their colleagues being lost to, you know, such gruesome methods in which some of the soldiers were killed. So tensions are running high on the border. There is high level of suspicion in both New Delhi and Beijing about each other, you know. we still don't have a very clear sense of why. In New Delhi, for instance, there is still no clear sense of why China did what it did, you know, which is actually to make this a very aggressive standoff to begin with, right? In New Delhi's looking at things, it believes that China did this as a part of a larger policy against India because India was getting closer to the US. Now, we don't know if that's true. And if that is true, then that policy hasn't really gone anywhere. You know, it's actually, you know, India and US have only gotten closer. So what does this mean then to, you know, to the situation on the border? Because we still have a border which is not defined by both partners. We still have a border which has not been demarcated by either of the two partners, right? So the suspicion and the tempers are still running very high. We still have certain places along the LAC where the standoff continues. There's been some de-escalation on some parts, but there is still heavy troop presence from both the Chinese and the Indian side, along with very heavy artillery and very heavy reinforcements on both sides. There are even reports that, you know, both countries are looking at beefing up its aerial support in these areas. So, you know, we're clearly seeing, you know, the militarization of the line of actual control in a way that we haven't seen before, especially not since the war in 1962. I don't believe this is going anywhere. Even if the standoff does end, I feel like India and China's relations, especially on the border, have now come to a point of a paradigm change, you know, where things will not be the same again. All of these years, you know, especially in New Delhi, you know, there was an anticipation that it only had to be constantly looking at the Pakistani border, you know, because that's where it would see insurgency, that's where it would see violence. Whereas on the Chinese border, all it had to do was watch its patrolling and watch the Chinese patrolling. It did not anticipate violence. It did not anticipate skirmishes of this kind. But now with what happened in June, that has changed completely. So the Indian side is going to be constantly cautious and extremely wary as well of what it sees. Because remember, India has always conjured up the situation of a two-front war. In policy circles, India has always been sort of looking at preparing itself for a two-front war with Pakistan and China. And what this situation and what this skirmish has done is that it's brought that particular situation way, way closer than it was before June 15, 2020.
That's all we have for you this week on the latest episode of Inside China. We're filing stories on the ongoing developments between China and India every day on the South China Morning Post website. And you can, of course, keep up to date with the latest articles filed by our guest contributor this week, Kunal Purawit, at smp.com. Now, here in Hong Kong, we're exercising heightened caution with the latest wave of coronavirus infections in our city, but we hope to have your regular hosts, Mimi Lau and Kinling Lo, back next week. Stay safe, wash your hands, keep your mask on, and thanks for sharing and reviewing the Inside China podcast. Bye for now.